Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Damian Thompson, standing in for Tim Stanley. This week, gendercide. Will the deliberate and disturbing abortion of girls change the way feminists and pro-lifers think about this issue? Could they find common ground, or will this debate become even more toxic? I'm joined in the studio by the New Statesman's Martha Gill and Madeline Tian of the Catholic Herald. Abortion is a huge issue in the United States. Every politician running for office has to state exactly where they stand on this complex, emotive issue. In Britain, politicians clear their throats and change the subject. Despite a minor change in the law, the status quo hasn't really altered since the Abortion Act of 1967. Abortion here is safe, legal, but not rare. There's little evidence that British public opinion feels strongly about this matter, but could so-called gendercide be a game-changer? It was The Telegraph that revealed last year that doctors have been arranging abortions simply because the parents didn't want a baby girl. Keir Starmer, the DPP, doesn't think this merits prosecution. Meanwhile, in India and China, gendercide is an everyday practice. In parts of India, 120 boys are born for every 100 girls. Martha Gill, should pro-choice feminists rethink their position on abortion because of this disturbing trend?
I don't think so. I think what we're doing here is muddling two issues together. There is, aborting female fetuses and being able to choose whether or not you want to have an abortion. I think the debate doesn't belong necessarily at the clinic door. The things which are no doubt products of a misogynistic society in India and in China, which cause women to respond to this by aborting female fetuses, the issues are way back in the chain, and they should be addressed back there rather than the burden of choice being put on the woman as she's deciding whether or not to have an abortion.
But supposing that the woman, society, the law, all think that gendercide is an acceptable procedure. Do you think that anything should be done to restore the balance?
Well, of course, but not with the individual woman and not with the clinics stopping this. I mean, you know, why should like a woman have to carry the burden of the misogynistic society, not only by addressing it by having abortion, but also the impossible demand of conducting her private life as like a protest against it? By not, so for example, she it's impossible for her to have a girl. She's pregnant with a girl, and she knows that if she has that girl, her husband is going to beat her up and abandon her, which does happen in certain parts of Southeast Asia. Or she's going to be financially ruined, as happens in with the dowry system in northern India. Should she sort of sacrifice her life as a sort of protest against this situation, or should she just react to it as a private individual?
I'm not sensing from what you say that the gendercide issue has caused you to rethink your basic commitment to a woman's right to choose.
No, it hasn't.
Madeline, I wanted to ask you, when the gendercide issue first hit the headlines, did you think that some sort of common ground might open up between pro-life and pro-choice lobbies?
Well, I think it was interesting, for example, that some quite outspoken pro-choice people, such as Emily Thornberry and Dr. Sarah Wollaston in Parliament, when the Telegraph investigation occurred in this country, they spoke out quite strongly against sex-selective abortion. And I think what I question is whether people such as Anne Faraday, who basically defended it and said that you can't be pro-choice and then stop when you don't like the choice, I don't think that that's necessarily representative of women, and it's certainly not representative of me. I think that even women who describe themselves as pro-choice would be horrified and alarmed that something which was supposed to emancipate and improve the welfare of women has actually been utilised as a misogynistic tool to wipe out baby girls. And I think I just find it extremely concerning. Obviously, as someone who believes in the right to life from conception, I'm concerned by any law which doesn't protect anyone, regardless of their genetic makeup, regardless of whether they're disabled, regardless of whether they're a boy or a girl. And I think from a purely humanitarian, egalitarian perspective, we should seek to protect the rights of all. And I'm quite frankly really quite horrified. And what was also quite notable about what the Telegraph did is that the girl that was filmed, she didn't say, I'm going to be beat up by my husband. She didn't say, anything really harrowing about not wanting a girl. She just said, oh, it's, we don't want a girl. And she said, and the doctor replied, I'm not here to ask questions. I can get that termination for you. I think that should send a chill down the spine of every woman in this country who cares about the welfare of women, because it certainly sent a chill down my spine.
Martha?
Well, look, you're sort of pointing towards a situation where, you know, for example, if there's a slight bias against girls in society, then, you know, eventually, if we don't do something about this, you know, all girls will be aborted. Well, there are controls there. Women don't like having abortions. It's not something which people go and do willingly. Mm. It's something people think carefully about, and it's something they do only in rather dire circumstances.
But perhaps I could put to you, Martha, the stories that we're hearing from human rights activists in India, where they say that a really rather extreme imbalance between the sexes means that there are, to put it crudely, fewer women available as sexual partners, which means that the incidence of rape and also human trafficking has increased as a direct result of gendercide. And what I wanted to ask you is there a point at which the imbalance between the sexes and the very serious demographic consequences of that, which nobody disputes, became so serious that you would wish to see stronger intervention, let's say, by the state or by the United Nations?
I think, of course, there should be if the consequences are, as you say, that dire. But I think this intervention should come in terms of reducing the pressures on women who then decide to have an abortion, abort female fetuses. What are the social situations which lead them to have this choice? And perhaps there are... there's a different policy, like financial incentives that go to boys in these countries should be evened out, rather than having a law directly about abortion, which then limits the woman's choice.
Madeline, do you think that these checks and balances that Martha's outlining could actually work in practice?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, I think that given that the we have our current law, and given how freely in the particular investigation we had, this woman obtained an abortion on the grounds of sex. I'm not very convinced by the checks and balances. I'm not convinced that, given we've had 6.6 million abortions since the legalisation, well, the decriminalisation of abortion in 67, that every single case was completely and utterly harrowing, i.e. rape, for example. There are multiple of reasons why women have abortions, of course, but I'm just staggered that we can't find some common ground in defending the humanity of the female baby. And I think that, you know, we should be able to speak out and condemn this for what it is, which is outright misogyny. But I also agree with you that we have to do things, and I think perhaps this is where the pro-life movement has failed somewhat, is that we have to do all we can to make abortion an increasingly obsolete, irrelevant thing, in that we have the social structures, the societal structures in place to support women through pregnancy. If you look, I don't know what the factors are. We haven't had a clear enough breakdown in this country, but a study in America in 2005, for example, showed that 2/3 of women chose to abort for financial reasons. Half of those chose to abort because they were in of relationship problems. And it saddens me to think that a woman would be compelled to go through such an invasive emotional trauma because she didn't have the support of money or welfare or even her community and her family. And I think that we need to look very seriously at those things. And I do think that it behoves anyone who identifies as pro-life to look at those things especially.
Well, perhaps one of the reasons that it's been difficult or impossible to find common ground is because the pro-life lobby has not just an image problem, but all sorts of internal disputes that make it a rather unhappy and impotent group of people. They failed to change the law in this country. When I was working at the Catholic Herald, I was very aware that the pro-life lobby was split into different groups of activists who hated each other like sectarians on the far left. Would you accept that something's gone badly wrong with the pro-life's ability to communicate with ordinary members of the British public, for whom, like it or not, abortion is not anywhere near the top of the political agenda?
I think that the pro-life movement is not a movement. It's fragmented. And I think, indeed, if it is a movement, it's a very mixed bunch, as you say. I think that it's appalling that some pro-life groups refuse to work with parliamentarians. I think Right to Life is the only group who will actually do so. And I think, yes, we do have an image problem. And I think the greatest scandal is that on our watch, we have seen the legalisation of abortion up to birth for handicapped children. And I think that that is a great scandal. And I think it's to our shame that that's occurred. And I think that actually what might help the pro-life movement is that they didn't throw so many issues into the pot. I mean, it's appalling that some of them are still campaigning on homosexuality and gay marriage. It's absolutely irrelevant to the issue of abortion. It's disgusting and it alienates people who identify as gay and are pro-life. And I think that's a great shame. I think it's a great distraction. So I think, yes, to a large extent, we have to take a long, hard look in the mirror and seek a real change. But I think that instrumental to that is showing real compassion for women and respecting women. And I think, sadly, there are very, very many compassionate women in the pro-life movement who are doing great work, such as Zoe's Place, for example, who are trying to support them. But I don't think they're the face of the pro-life movement, and I think that is a real problem.
You mentioned abortion up to birth, late-term abortions. This is one area where I sense that perhaps public opinion is malleable, and I wanted to ask Martha, in your opinion, is there a moral distinction between abortion up to birth, that is the abortion of a baby who could survive outside of the womb, and infanticide? Because I don't get it, personally.
Perhaps not. I don't know. It's very difficult to draw a moral line on these things, isn't it? I think that the medical community has actually done it the best. I think these things are best drawn medically, and then our morals come later. I think it's 24 weeks, or is it 28
weeks?
You may say that, but
if you look at the dreadful case of the Gosnell murders in America, here was a rogue backstreet abortionist. No, actually, legal abortionist, but who was performing illegal abortions, and it didn't seem to make any difference to him whether he killed the baby inside or outside the womb. It just really wasn't an issue for him.
Well, he's
not necessarily an isolated case.
Well, if you're asking me if I condone illegal abortions, then and abortions past the 28-week cut-off point, 28 now,
absolutely not. What should the cut-off point be, in your opinion?
Well, I think it should be decided by doctors. I think they do it so if the fetus can survive outside the womb without too much medical help, then it shouldn't be aborted at that point.
That raises a very interesting question, because medical science is likely to push down the point at which a baby can survive outside the womb. Don't you?
Yes.
That worries me, because I think that sort of logic is incredibly individualistic and actually quite brutal. There will be many children who, you know, when a child is born, that child depends on its parents for survival. And even more so when that child is severely handicapped, for example, severely disabled. Of course they depend on medical care. And it astonishes me that the left, that's, you know, based on principles of humanity, of egalitarianism, can take such a sort of individualistic, brutal approach to this question. I don't understand it, and I think that this is the problem that we're facing, isn't it? Is where that cutoff point lies.
Well, we're never going to find an absolute moral point. At 12 weeks, the baby definitely becomes sort of a moral being with rights. We're never going to find that. I think what doctors are trying to do is, as you put the point very, very strongly, trying to draw a balance between, you know, the fact we don't want to kill babies. And the other point is that babies are actually a huge burden on a person. If you think about it, you probably still phone at your mother quite a lot, so probably she probably still, you know, I mean I'm 27, I take up quite a lot of my mother's time, I'm still a burden on her. I think that it should be opt-in, because for the reason that it is medically possible for it to be opt-in. Now, this is it's a completely life-changing thing to have a child. It changes you forever. And it in rich countries, this is where it becomes a feminist issue in rich countries, because you absolutely feel the pressure of the glass ceiling when you have a child. That is the point when people start, I don't feel it yet, but if I have a child, I definitely will. And in poor countries, it's the turning point in a poor country where women get access, where women stop having to just have children whenever, wherever. They get access to contraception. And like it or not, abortion is a part of that, because mistakes do happen and people don't always get access to contraception.
I mean, the frightening thing about the glass ceiling is, I think that, again, it's reflective of, you know, we live in a capitalist society where often women are valued, well, humans are valued for their economic worth, for what they can earn, for their earning power, ultimately. Mm. And rather than seeing women having to resort to abortion just in order to stay in a job, in order to progress, I'd rather see more provision for women to juggle those two things. And I think that people don't like to hear it, it's uncomfortable, but the reality is that we have an abortion law where we can abort disabled people up to birth, and the procedure is barbaric. And I won't go into the details now, because it's not what everyone wants to hear, but ultimately it is barbaric if you look it up, if you look into it. And this happens on our watch. Once a disabled child is born, you can't go anywhere without an uproar if there's not disabled ramps, if there's not an ethos of equality. But whilst that child is in the womb, that child has absolutely no rights, and not equal rights to, as you would say, healthy children in the womb. And I think that that's a great scandal. And I think actually that is something that people who believe in humanism, in equality, can speak out about. And we can unite on the issue of the abortion of disabled children up to birth, which, quite frankly, is a scandal.
Mm. Martha, the discrimination against disabled babies in the womb does seem rather creepy, does seem a little bit Nazi, actually, in some ways. What's your response?
Well, I agree with you, actually, Madeline, on the fact that it does seem barbaric, and in a society, in an ideal society, and hopefully one we are going towards, it would be no less, or parents would be able to care and have the support to care for these children, and it wouldn't make a difference. Unfortunately, we don't live in that society, so equally barbaric sometimes is the sight of a mother without adequate financial or emotional support or social support, trying to basically giving over her entire life to support a child who is disabled. And that gets very barbaric in
I don't think
countries.
It's barbaric. I think that it's an act of altruism, and I think it's what any mother would do. I'm very
No. I'm not saying the mother is barbaric. I'm saying the situation looked at from an outsider, and what her life has become is...
Yeah, looked at from an outsider. But when you're actually in that position, and if you think about the amount of disabled people who, for example, are horrified by assisted suicide, they're horrified by it because of the presumption we have as outsiders that it would be, you know, a fate worse than death to be disabled. Yet disabled people will articulate, no, I don't want an assisted suicide law because it's not a fate worse than death. I love my life. And there are plenty of disabled mothers, mothers of disabled children who do have support. Yes, they need more support, absolutely. But they are happy as mothers, as women who love their children unconditionally to raise them. And no woman, when she's told, you know, your daughter's going to have Downs, leaps for joy. I think that's highly unlikely. But I do know many women who accept it and go on to have the child. And that child has enriched their life so much. One can have absolutely no idea to the extent to which that child enriches their life.
I wonder if I could...
I'd like to respond to that, but yeah, sure.
Of course, please do.
Oh, sorry. Well, you talk about it as an altruistic act. An altruistic act is only altruistic if you're not forced into doing it, right? If it's a choice.
But it isn't a choice.
No doubt...
Look, but no, what kind of choice?
This, your point was an argument for the woman, when she knows that she has a child with Down syndrome, having the most information she possibly can about the situation, speaking to other parents with Down's children who love the children and have an amazing time with them and it's enriched their lives, learning about all the support they can properly get. So that then they therefore can make a choice. And it's also an argument for increasing that support. But I don't think it's an argument for forcing women to carry the child to full term and have it and spend their lives looking after it in the imperfect society which we have, which doesn't really provide us
with... Okay, a very, very, very tricky area. And just to underline the complexity of this debate, I've got a quote here from Jermaine Greer, who's very unequivocally pro-choice, but she wrote, "Expecting women to be grateful for the opportunity to have inserted into their bodies instruments for sucking and scraping out the products of avoidable conception shows them contempt." But then she goes on to say that we should impose on men the duty to prevent unwanted pregnancies. Do you agree with her, Martha?
Well, I think that that is... of course, that would be great, but men don't have to face the consequences of it to quite the same extent, and I think that that's unrealistic. I think that women are always, because they face the heaviest consequences for accidental pregnancy, etc., they are always going to be the ones who are motivated to take the highest precautions. So I think that yes, it would be great if men had a greater role in that, and we should be pushing for that, but I think realistically it's not going to happen.
Well, it might also be said, Madeline, that one of the problems with getting men to take responsibility for conception is that the Catholic Church blocks off that escape route, if you like, by saying they can't actually use contraception.
Well, I think that's that would be a narrow presentation of the Church's view on sexuality. You have to look at it in its entire context. And of course, the Church says that sex should take place inside of a marriage. And I would imagine that, you know, inside of a marriage which is built on love and trust and all those things. So I think to take the Church's position and then apply it to a situation where Church teaching might not have been followed in the first place is not particularly helpful. I do think that the problem with abortion is I do think that it lets men off the hook, and that really, really worries me. And it distresses me to think that women have to go through this invasive procedure, this emotional trauma, potentially alone, and that they are faced with that decision on their own. And anecdotally, you hear all the time about women who feel pressured to have an abortion. We talk about choice, but think about relational autonomy. Nobody makes a decision such as that in complete isolation. There are other factors influencing them, and it does concern me that men can, you know, either pressure a woman into an abortion and say, "I wash my hands of this. It's your choice, but it's a really lonely choice to make on your own."
I didn't particularly want to turn this into a discussion about the Catholic Church, but nonetheless, I think a lot of women hear pro-lifers saying late-term abortions are a bad thing, and they agree. But then they also factor in the belief, the pro-life belief of Catholics, for example, that you can't use a condom to stop it happening in the first place, and that makes no sense to them whatsoever.
Yeah, but I think that you have to remember that not everyone in the pro-life movement would agree with that for a start. I think that the pro-life movement, of course, has to take an evidence-based approach. I think they are sceptical, as many people are, as to what extent aggressive programmes of sex education are antagonising the problem, for example. You know, the availability of the morning after pill. Are people taking... Are teenagers, for example, taking greater risks because they think that they have that safety net? And is that leading to all of the sorts of problems, such as sexually transmitted diseases? But I do take your point in terms of, you know, the Church's position on contraception, but I think one has to place it in its wider context. And I think ultimately, you talk about Jermaine Greer. Well, in that chapter on abortion in her book, she mentions, you know, Cardinal Winning raising funds in order to support women who are contemplating abortion. And I think the Church is on the ground on this and is trying as best they can to cultivate practical solutions for women who are facing crisis pregnancies.
Just to round up our discussion, I wanted to ask Martha, is there anything that, in your opinion, could shift liberal opinion towards tighter restrictions on abortion?
I think that liberal opinion places the woman above her child morally. And I think that is the difference between the liberal opinion and the more conservative one. Therefore, if there was a change which, for example, kept the woman's choice open in that way, but also tightened up abortion controls, like, for example, we found out medically that babies can feel pain up to X number of weeks, and the argument was made there. So, for example, the woman would have to make the choice earlier on in the pregnancy. That would restrict women's choice, perhaps, but I don't know. There's a boundary there to be made. I mean, the morally placing the woman above her child, above her unborn fetus, is not. There are degrees to which the boundaries are shifted between them, and I think a medical opinion could probably make a difference there. I can't see any other way in which it would be shifted.
Madeline Tin, Martha Gill, thank you
Thanks.
Very much.
Thanks.